On the Philosopher's Zone today, awe and wonder.
I went up to the flight deck to see the view, and wow, it was incredible. Everything seemed to be floating. Me, the shuttle, and the Earth, all in different orientations.
The astronauts did a good job in describing some of these things, but then we suddenly realized there might be some things going on here that did not fall into those categories. There was something we were missing. And what we were missing was the idea that there was a kind of ineffability of these kinds of experiences.
Have you checked out the star logs on the NASA site? Sean Gallagher has. For the past few years, he's led a team of psychologists, neuroscientists, engineers, and philosophers like himself to study a special case of awe and wonder. The sort you find in some of those NASA reports, where views of deep space or of Earth from a distance inspire some deeply felt reactions. Gallagher's team analysed astronaut diaries and went as far as trying to simulate the experience in virtual labs here on Terra Firma to try and get a clear view of awe and wonder.
Yeah, so we called our study a form of neurophenomenology. So the phenomenology part is the philosophical part. You may know that there's a historical tradition starting in Europe with Edmund Husserl that is called phenomenology. And phenomenology is the area of philosophy that is concerned about experience, what exactly experience is like. They try to develop descriptions of different types of experience. They try to understand perception, memory, imagination, things like that. This was an important philosophical movement that also was connected with existentialism in France, for example. So there is a phenomenological method that we used in this study, and the philosophers were the ones who were able to train some of the interviewers to use this type of method.
That's what people in the actual lab reported on. But you also looked at star logs. You also looked at what real astronauts, for want of a better word, could come back to Earth.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we needed a starting point. And the starting point was with the reports of the astronauts who originally had these experiences. They kept star journals. I mean, they kept journals during their spaceflight.
I like the term.
Yeah, that's nice. And these journals are available online. If you go to the NASA website, you'll find astronauts' journals, and you can read them. And they're about all kinds of different things, about technology, about how you can cook in space, and all kinds of things. But there are a good number of them that really focus on this experience that they report. Specifically when they are looking out the window of the space shuttle or the International Space Station. And for the most part, they're looking at the Earth in close Earth orbit. So they're having experiences that are like these experiences of awe and wonder, and then they're writing in their journal about those. And so they have very specific descriptions. And some of them also write about it when they come back. So they have interviews, or they are writing a chapter of a book or something like that, and they'll go into some detail. So we had over 50 descriptions from about 45 different astronauts of what these experiences were like. So that was our starting point. And then, and here's where philosophy comes back into it again, we needed to do a kind of hermeneutical analysis, an interpretation that would try to understand what exactly those experiences were like and try to come up with some categories that would allow us to specify in more detail than simply saying, oh, they had an experience of awe. We ended up with 34 different categories of experience that fit in with the types of things we were interested in exploring.
34 categories. So beyond just the simple categories of wonder and awe. Yeah?
Right. These are categories that you would say specify what we mean by awe or wonder.
Mm. So give me an example of what perhaps some of those were.
Yeah, one good example is what we called scale effects. So the idea was something like they would describe the vastness of the universe that they could see out the window. And then that gave them a sense that they were very small, or that the Earth was very small compared to that vastness.
Mm. Interesting you've used scale, because I was going to talk to you about scale as one way of being able to understand this experience that the astronauts are having. But just in relation to the Starlogs versus those who had not left Earth but were experimented upon, or at least looked at, the ones here in the virtual lab, was there some crossover in the way that they represented their feelings?
What I can say is that we replicated the kinds of descriptions that the astronauts were giving as they were traveling in space. We replicated those in this simulation, virtual reality type setup, so that in the phenomenological interview, you know, asking them to report on their experience, we were getting very, very similar types of reports that we could, again, use the categories that we took from the astronauts and use them to understand what we were getting from the subjects in the experiment. Mm.
And just so I get a picture, they're in a virtual lab, but they're basically, to all intents and purposes, you're recreating that experience of being in space, yeah?
Yes.
Except I imagine gravity would be an issue.
Yeah. There were a lot of limitations on this study.
Yeah.
Gravity is certainly one of them. Mm. One can simulate the absence of gravity on Earth, so weightlessness, but it's hard to do, first of all, and secondly, you couldn't do that and also present the stimuli, which were visual stimuli that were generating these types of experiences.
Yes.
So we had to live with that.
So in the end, you had these 34 categories, you've got star logs, you've got these experiments. What did you come up with? What did it point to in terms of this question about awe and wonder?
So we got, let's say, a lot of information. In fact, probably too much data to analyze all of it. Data from EEG especially, but we also got the phenomenological interviews, the replication, and specifically in those categories we were looking for. We also realized closer to the end of the project, and this was one of the philosophers on the team who knew the history of mysticism and those kinds of experiences, we finally realized that there was something we were missing.
Mm-hmm.
And what we were missing was the idea that there was a kind of ineffability of these kinds of experiences, that they were difficult to describe. So the astronauts did, you know, a good job in describing some of these things, and we were able to draw on their descriptions to form those categories. But then we suddenly realized there might be some things going on here that did not fall into those categories. And then we went back looking at the data, and we saw that a number of the subjects were just having trouble expressing. So they were looking for words and couldn't find the words.
Mm.
So at first we had, you know, in the original analysis, we had simply pushed that aside. They didn't fall into the category. So, and then we suddenly realized towards the end, there is something here that might be interesting to look at. What is it that they couldn't say? But then you have the problem of, well, how do you get to that?
Mm.
There's
a number of questions that come to mind there. Two other terms that were important to you were also curiosity and humility. Just tell me about those two in relation to awe and wonder and why they were also part of this.
They're connected to awe and wonder, right? So you can think of curiosity as being closely connected to wonder. If I start wondering about the nature of the universe, and maybe that goes in an intellectual direction, then curiosity becomes a kind of driving force in order to try to pursue that. So curiosity seemed to be something closely related, and we found, especially in the astronauts, a lot of curiosity about, you know, trying to figure out what it all means. And that shows up also in some of the subjects.
Mm.
So if you think of awe, then it's also the case that awe will generate a kind of humility. Goes back to that idea of scale effects. So here's the vastness of the universe, and here I am, very small, floating around in the spaceship, or even very small planet of Earth. And so you get a sense of a humility that comes out of that, I think.
It's very interesting. Looking at some of the graphs and some of the numerical representations of the results, it seems that scale is the one that really hits the home runs, if I can use an American term, or a six in Australian cricket terms, English terms, because it seems that once you look at that as a variable, that's the one that seems to be most connected with, I felt the most awe, or I felt the most wonder, or I felt the most humility.
That's right, yeah. And it leads to moral questions of ethics. So the idea that the planet Earth is so small compared to the rest of the universe also kind of motivates thoughts about, you know, what we're doing on that planet. So both in terms of ecological concerns about the environment and also in terms of concern about other people on the planet. You find this both in the astronauts and in our subjects who were really voicing a kind of ethical concern about the idea that, you know, we're all living on this planet and you know, there's so many people in poverty, and then the motivation of, you know, why should I be so privileged? Everybody else is in poverty. So it really kind of motivated that type of concern as well.
Yes, it's interesting because it starts to bridge back to this question of, well, the ineffable. And I suppose some people might say, look, you're looking at a religious concept there, not necessarily a philosophical concept. And I wonder what a philosopher does, like yourself, caught with a situation where trying to express the ineffable and trying to actually bring some rational rigor to it is in fact quite difficult.
Yeah. I don't necessarily categorize it as religious in all cases. In some cases, yes. You know, in a lot of the descriptions, you had the descriptions framed in terms of a creator, God, and so forth, and some of the ethical concerns then become taken into that framework. But then there are others. So some of the astronauts are atheists, they're hard-nosed scientists. They didn't expect to have these experiences, and yet they were surprised and awed by what they experienced. So even there, they had to express it, and sometimes they expressed it in just purely aesthetic terms, you know, of how beautiful the whole thing is. And wow, that's overwhelming in a sense.
Mm. Did I read correctly? There was an interesting sidelight to this, that some of those who were self-professed religious weren't as awed as some of the others who were atheists.
Yeah, yeah. So we used a questionnaire. It's called the BMMRS, which stands for the Brief Multidimensional Measure of Religiosity and Spirituality. And that gave us what we thought at first was a paradoxical result. What it showed was that the more religious the subjects were, just in terms of engaging in religious practices, either meditation or going to church, you know, those types of things, the more religious they were, the less awe they experienced in the simulation, and then vice versa. The less religious you are, the more awe you get. So that seemed to us, wow, that's strange, because, you know, a lot of people associate awe with a religious type of mentality. So one possible explanation of this is that someone who is engaged in religious practice might have a kind of larger framework within which they can fit such experiences. Maybe they think of the universe, you know, in a way that can accommodate these types of experiences, and they don't seem to be therefore as strong as they are in other people who might not have the same kind of framework to work with.
Just to that question of scalability, this sort of thing, could it just not be replicated in a drive down to the beach on the weekend and looking at the ocean from, I know, the cliff tops,
yeah,
or going to the desert and watching the sunrise or sunset or a moon? I mean, this is, yeah, the kind of thing we're talking about as being lost in the size of things.
That's right. One question we have and can't really answer is, how different are these experiences that astronauts have, or in this type of simulation context, how different are those experiences from just those other kinds of experiences that are associated with awe? You know, standing on a mountain or being in a desert at sunset or whatever. So people do report those kinds of experiences or experiences with art, music. And the question would be, are they exactly the same experiences? This is something the phenomenologist would be interested in. You know, are these precisely the same experiences that the astronauts are having, or is the difference in context important? And would that determine some differences in the actual experiential part of it? So we did, I think, pretty clearly come to understand that it was the visuals that were generating this. So in almost every description by the astronauts, it was when they were sitting by the window looking at the Earth or looking into deep space that they had these experiences. And they would sometimes describe the idea that they really want to go back to the window. They want to have that experience again. They start looking forward to their break times when they can go back to the window and so forth. So we figured that's got to be it. And of course, our simulations were based on visual stimuli, very much simulating the kind of environment that they were seeing out the windows.
So out of the sort of philosophical projects you follow, this would have been a pretty good fun one, I guess.
It was a great deal of fun. We had Jeff Williams, who is an astronaut, on our advisory board, who came and tried out our simulations, and he's heading back into space pretty soon, actually. So he is also someone who actually had these experiences, so it was quite helpful to have him about.
Get him to take a diary.
Yeah.
It's the vastness of reality. I started thinking of how huge our universe is. This is just a little part of what I'm looking at. And how much more there is.
More details on Sean Gallagher's project on our site. On the Philosopher's Zone today, we're in awe. Socrates did say that wisdom begins in wonder, and someone who's been giving it some thought is Jesse Prince.
Well, I've had a long interest in what one might call the distinctively human institutions. What are the things that mark us off as a cultural creature from other animals who are quite closely related biologically? And among the chief institutions that distinguish human life from the life of non-human animals are things like religion, things like systems of morality, things like science, and things like art, fine art. And I began to wonder, what is it about these institutions that makes them so available to us, so exciting for us, and so invisible for other creatures? And to my surprise, there seems to be a kind of unification, a common denominator in the emotion of wonder. And if you just look at science, religion, and art, they seem to be antithetical. Art is about imaginary worlds where science is about the real world, and religion is about the supernatural world where science is about the natural world. Reconciling these three very distinctive human institutions seems like a fool's errand since they're so obviously miles apart. But what they do share is a sense of wonder, an underlying sense of the extraordinary. So wonder, I think, is this emotion that makes the world seem special to us. And that specialness gives rise to the kinds of reflection we see in religious thought, the mysteries of the world that are brought on by a sense of wonder. Likewise, those mysteries provoke us to engage in scientific inquiry, and the purely pleasurable experience we get in seeing the extraordinary leads us to look at the natural world in very aesthetic ways, the beauty of nature, but also to create beauty of our own through the arts.
The way you've described it, though, is non-naturalistic in some ways. I mean, with your empiricist eyes on, and I know that that's the way you like to view the world or understand the world, should I say, in a way that's sort of creating another layer, another tier, dare I say it, a spiritual tier perhaps, or some other tier that can't be named in a naturalistic setting.
I've always been something of of the village atheist. I've never taken spiritual discourse particularly seriously. I've looked down my nose at people who have claimed that spirituality is important to human life, and I've really had a complete reversal on that. And the reversal comes in large part from seeing that spirituality is not at all restricted to organized religion. It's not at all restricted to the supernatural. Spirituality is a kind of deep reverence we have for things that are extraordinary. And I think the world is full of things that are extraordinary. I think scientific discoveries, like the very fact that the physical objects we encounter in life are just seas of swarming microparticles, is such a spectacular thought that it fills us with a kind of reverent wonder. And obviously, those who engage in consumption of the arts, I'm a regular museum goer, or those who enjoy going to music or watching dance, are really indulging in something very akin to a religious religious ritual. You're acquiescing to an experience where you disengage from the normal demands of practical life and allow yourself to experience something that shows prodigious talent, extraordinary beauty, and so on. Those are very much spiritual experiences.
But is it the case, or possibly the case, that all we're really doing is partaking in the evolutionary psychological chain that's gone for, you know, eons before us, and we're fulfilling some kind of function in that adaptation game, in that adaptation dance?
I tend to think that wonder is a somewhat recent development and maybe even a kind of cultural invention, or at least something that hasn't been allowed to flourish until we've achieved certain levels of cultural achievement. And the reason for that is partially based on the anthropological or archaeological record. So if you look at the very institutions I've talked about, so science, religion, and art, they're quite recent in human history. And Homo sapiens are 200,000 years old, and we don't see sculpture and painting emerging till about 40,000 years ago. And evidence for religious ritual is not much older than that, and science is probably a great deal younger. So what seems to be going on here is it's almost as if we have to get to a level where subsistence is sufficiently secure, maybe through very stable forms of hunting and gathering, maybe even through small-scale agriculture, that we can step back and start to reflect and enjoy on the mysteries of life. So I don't think wonder is something that emerged under evolutionary pressure, and I don't think religion, science, and art have been particularly conducive to our development as a species. We were already fully formed as a species well before these institutions appeared. Wonder is a kind of luxury that creatures like us can partake in.
It's an interesting form of excess, which I know must, and it does, and as art does, confound many who wish to ground it in something much more explicable in that evolutionary chain.
I'm a great believer in excess. I think there's been a long-standing philosophical interest in the meaning of life, and at least construed a certain way, that's a profoundly uninteresting question. And what I have in mind is life is full of a certain kind of practical meaning. We're constantly struggling to find the resources, to house ourselves, to feed ourselves, looking for mates. So the kinds of concerns that evolutionary theory has emphasized are very central to all animal activity, and human activity is just a special case of that. To that extent, if you ask, why did you engage in this activity? Maybe why did you pursue a certain career, or why did you go out on that date last night? An evolutionary answer suggests itself in a way that makes questions of meaningfulness easy to answer. But what makes human life so distinctive is that we engage in meaningless activities, activities that are removed from the practical to such a degree that they generate a kind of puzzle. So I think the most profound question about humanity is, why is life so meaningless? Why do we make room in our lives for things that have no clear and obvious payoff? One of the dangers of an overly evolutionary approach to human life is that the human species is precisely distinctive because we transcend our animality. And that sounds like a bit of a cliche and maybe a kind of speciesism. But if you think about it, the human story begins where evolution lets off. If you want to try to understand the behavior of non-human animals, typically an evolutionary story will get you darn near to a full accounting of their daily activities. But human beings have this capacity for flexibility, for change, for cultural adaptation, for incremental learning that allows us to constantly evolve past the biological stage, past biological evolution. Our constant creation of new technologies and even new forms of entertainment are a reflection of the fact that we have transcended biology to an extraordinary degree. To tell the human story is not to engage in evolutionary thinking, but to precisely engage in an account of what we can do after evolution has stopped.
And in the end, it may all just be a big mystery.
I think we shouldn't be afraid of mystery. On the other hand, I do think that one of the exciting things that we've begun to see is that many of the activities that humans engage in are susceptible to scientific inquiry. One of the biases that I find in recent approaches to the mind is people think if you're going to explain human behavior scientifically, you have to do it in terms of evolution or biology or neuroscience. I think if you want to explain human behavior, you need to take into consideration history. You need to take into consideration anthropology and culture. So it's those dimensions that are starting to complete or round out the scientific inquiry into human behavior in ways that are making us look less mysterious than we have in the past.
Jesse Prince, distinguished professor of philosophy at the City University of New York, working on a theory of wonder. Thanks this week to Diane Dean and Judy Rapley. I'm Joe Gelonesi. See you again in the Philosopher's Zone.